Thank you very much, Sheikh Ahmed, for your words of wisdom. Our final speaker for the evening is Malcolm Shabazz, the grandson of Malcolm X. It is our honor to welcome him on his first and hopefully not his last trip to Montreal. Malcolm Latif Shabazz is the first male descendant of his grandfather, Elhaj Malikin Shabazz, better known as Malcolm X. He shares more than his blood, but also a similar arc of life, going from a youth with a troubled adolescence to one of increasing awareness and purpose. Much like his grandfather, he has had an awakening through the transformative power of Islam and its positive impact on life, eventually finding himself retracing the footsteps and experiencing much of the sights and hospitality that Malcolm X had experienced by embarking this past year on the sacred pilgrimage to Mecca known as Hajj, followed by a journey to Africa where he spoke at the African Union Conference in Libya. Today he picks up the cause that his grandfather held dear, that of human rights, social justice, and the empowerment of the dance movement, all while being rooted in the teachings of Islam. It is difficult to introduce Brother Malcolm without making mention of his name, especially at an event that celebrates the legacy of Elhaj Malik Shabazz. However, he is also a brother who we are pleased to have with us in his own right, and look forward to hearing not only about his grandfather, but his own journey and endeavors. Brother Malcolm will speak on his activities and how the struggle for human rights continues in North America. Please welcome.
Tennessee State University in America is considered to be a historical black university. And the department I spoke at was the African American Studies Department. About 300 or so people. I asked them this question. I said, by show of hands, how many of you have read the autobiography of Malcolm X? One person raised their hand. One person. That person came with me. and he was a Christian Baptist minister. So I asked them by a show of hands, how many of you have saw a movie produced by Spike Lee? Maybe 1/4 of the audience raised their hand. And I told them, I said, no, this is something that's totally unacceptable. You know, historical black university, African American studies department, and nobody read the autobiography of Malcolm X. This is something that I understand is totally by design. But very briefly, I'll share a key point about my grandfather. And this is that in 1950s, my grandfather had joined the nation, an organization called the Nation of Islam. How many of you are familiar with this organization, the Nation of Islam? The Nation of Islam was, it could be considered to be somewhat of a deviant sect, where they taught that the black man was a god and the white man was a devil, and a lot of real esoteric teachings, things that the Muslims don't support today. But my grandfather joined this organization. He joined it at a time when many African-Americans, so-called African-Americans, wouldn't be able to accept Islam as we know it today. You know, many of them, they wouldn't be able to read the Arabic and go through the Quran, and you know, it would be harder for them to accept it in that time period. This was a time period where black people were coming out of deep-rooted hatred, oppression, and you couldn't even tell, a black man couldn't even tell his own mother that God wasn't white, that Jesus wasn't white, because this is something that was thoroughly ingrained within the mentality and the culture of the people. So my grandfather joined this organization, the Nation of Islam, and had about 200 to 400 members. And he was put in charge of setting up different temples, Islamic temples all over the country. This is a time when if you were to tell somebody, I'm Muslim and my religion is Islam, people would say, what is that? They'd never heard of it before at that time. So he joined this organization and he was placed in charge of setting up all these temples all over the country. And within a 10-year period, the membership went from 200 to 400 to hundreds of thousands of members. Later, my grandfather, he went on his Hajj to Mecca, and he had an awakening. This was at a time many so-called African Americans didn't venture outside of the United States. They weren't able to. And in the Nation of Islam, they taught that everyone in Mecca was black, and that you couldn't even get into Mecca unless you were black. So you can imagine the rude awakening my grandfather had when he made his Hajj. You know, when he made his Hajj, he said that for the first time in his life, he felt like a complete human being. He said that he sat down with people who in America would be considered to be white based on the color of their skin, and they had blue eyes and blonde hair, but they were sitting down, drinking from the same cup, eating from the same plate, and praying together with dark-skinned Africans, and everyone was equal under Islam. So when he came back, you know, he renounced his previous views, and he said that you might be surprised hearing it come from him, but he said he would never again put a blanket indictment over an entire race of people. One of the things my grandfather said, he said that white people can help us, but they can't join us. And you gotta keep in mind the time period, take this into consideration. And the reason why he said that white people could help, but they could not join, he said because before there can be black and white solidarity, there has to be black solidarity. Because for hundreds of years, black people were taught how to hate themselves, and black people needed to learn how to love themselves and work amongst their own before they could go out and try to work alongside everybody else. He said if white people wanted to help, then they should go in their communities and bring consciousness and awareness to their people. And the same way that we're trying to bring awareness and consciousness to our people, and then somewhere down the line we can meet up and organize and work together. Me growing up, I didn't realize who I was. You know, I didn't know I was the grandson of Malcolm X. I didn't realize what it was to be a part of the family that I'm from or to represent this legacy. But there's three different stages about my life where I came into a greater awareness of this. And the first time was when I was 10 years old and I was living in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is heavily populated with Muslims. It's one of the most heavily populated Muslim cities in the United States, but it's also a very rough neighborhood. I lived there 2 years straight, excluding the summers. And I remember I was 10 and I was just coming home from a summer camp in New York. My grandmother was dropping me off at the people's house that I was staying with, but they weren't home. So we pulled up, the family wasn't there, and she had to catch a flight. So she gave me about $3,000 in cash, and she gave me a check, and she told me, give this to the lady when she gets back. I said, okay. So she left, you know, to catch her flight. And I'm sitting on the steps, and I seen some friends I hadn't saw them all summer. They were excited to see me. And they said, hey, let's go around the corner and grab a bite to eat. I said, sure. So we went around to the corner to the store, and we were ordering sandwiches, And here it is, I'm this 10-year-old kid, and I pull out this big wad of money. And there's some kids out on the block, 16, 17, and they see me with this big wad of money. So as I come outside, they go in my pockets and they take my money from me. And I try to fight them, but I'm too small. So they get the best of me. And I get back to my block, and I'm sitting on the steps, and I'm very sad. I remember there was this Muslim sister. See, I just took her shahada. And she came out, and she was wearing hijab and abaya, all white. And she asked me, she said, "Brother, what's wrong? You look very sad." And I told her what had just happened. She said, "Brother, don't worry about it." And she went in the house and made a phone call. When she came out, not too long after that, there were about 30 or so Muslim brothers that came to the block. They had a lot of order and discipline. Only two of them approached me. One of them spoke to me. He asked me what happened. I explained the situation to him. And he said, "Brother, don't worry about it." And they all left. Not too long after that, they came back, the two brothers. And the brother gave me more money that then was taken from me, and he had the check. And the next time I seen the individuals that were present that day, that robbed me, they said, "Brother, we didn't realize you were a Muslim. We didn't know who you were. If you ever have any problems around here again, please let us know. We got your back." And at this age of 10, I didn't realize what was going on, but it was something that made me really sit back and reflect and ask myself, what is this about? I always knew that my family was held in high esteem, and people treated them a little bit differently, but I never really thought about why. Another time was when I went to prison. I did 3.5 years straight, and a total of 6 years in various maximum security prisons throughout New York State, like Attica, Comstock, Auburn, and so forth. I was in an environment where a lot of these brothers have life, never even going home. And when I got there, I was a teenager, I was 16, I was a little wild, I wasn't on my team. And the brothers had took the position that nothing should happen to me, no matter if I was in the wrong. And I'm not going to say that's right, but this is the position that they took. If anything, even if I did anything wrong, that nothing should happen to me. And to see this type of attitude, it made me really sit back and reflect, like, wow, what is this about? The most recent time when I came into a greater awareness is when I began to travel. And I've been all over the Middle East, from Dubai, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, and all over the Middle East and Europe. And when I went to the Middle East, what I noticed is that in many of these Islamic countries, Muslim countries, the average person doesn't know who Malcolm X is. And if you say Malcolm X, you say, who's that? Unless they're highly educated or they're a scholar. Yet when I went to Europe, in places like France, where I was born, unfortunately, Germany, Belgium, Switzerland, Holland, everyone knew who Malcolm X was. They would get very excited, it was to the extent they would get more excited than people from America, and I went to France the year before last, and then I stepped off the plane, they had the red carpet out. I stayed in a hotel that night, they played the movie Malcolm X Hotel all night. When I would go to eat, in 4-star, 5-star restaurants, they would shut, the restaurant down and nobody could get in except for me and my people. So this is very interesting that here it is you have in the Islamic countries and the Muslim countries, the majority of the people are unaware of Malcolm X. But in the secular societies and the atheist societies and the countries where they tell you there's no God and they're against religion, everyone knew who Malcolm X was and they were very excited and they, it was just very interesting. And I understand this is something that's by design. In America, for Martin Luther King, when you celebrate his birthday in school, you get days off and so forth. But for Malcolm X, you don't get anything. And this is because they want to promote Martin Luther King. They would like us to take the position of Martin Luther King. They don't want us to be like Malcolm X, El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz. Many times when people meet me, they either take the position that, we're for Martin Luther King, we really can't get down with what your grandfather represented because he was a disgruntled militant. Or sometimes people, when they meet me, they'll take the position, we're all for what your grandfather was about, we can't get what Martin Luther King saw. But for me, I believe that Malcolm X, my grandfather, and Martin Luther King, both of their movements were just as significant. They can be considered to be on opposite sides of the spectrum, where my grandfather, Malcolm X, was a Muslim, and Martin Luther King was Christian. Martin Luther King preached that you should turn the other cheek, that if a man strikes you, give him the other cheek and let him strike you again. My grandfather stated that you should never be the aggressor, but if a man puts his hand on you, then you make sure that he doesn't have the ability to put his hand on anybody else. You protect yourself, you protect your home, you protect your family. Now, if I lived in that time period, I don't think I would have took the position of Martin Luther King. I think I would be more prone to defend myself, and this is what we believe in Islam. But at the same time, I have respect for his movement, and I understand it. And I take many different things into consideration. There's different variables. One is the time period. Another one is the introduction of the television into many homes. During this time, many homes were just getting televisions. Television had just came out. So all over the world, people could watch the tube and see what was going on in the United States when the United States was trying to portray to the rest of the world that they were trying to fix the race problem, but they were exposed. All over the world, people could see in the United States that the government was sicking dogs on women and children, spraying them with high-powered hoses, women and children that were protesting peacefully, non-violently. Yet, you know, if Martin Luther King would have had his people out there fighting, they would know the nature of the enemy and how they operate with their media. They would just put a spin on it and make it seem as if they're only containing the riot. So being that Martin Luther King had his people out there protesting peacefully, it was able to expose America for what it was. So I respect that. You know, I remember I was younger, and I used to watch these old war movies. I think a lot of y'all might be familiar with the old war movies, where you have two opposing forces on the battlefield, and they're marching towards each other head on, killing each other off, just shooting at each other, killing each other off. And I remember when I was younger, I would watch these movies, and I would think to myself, wow, that doesn't seem very intelligent. Why do they fight like that? But we today, opposing forces, militaries, they don't fight like this. You know, they develop some guerrilla forces and guerrilla tactics. You know, we all can't come at the enemy from the same angle in the same direction. We have to come at the enemy in different angles and different directions. So who is the enemy? That's the question. You know, one of the things my grandfather, he was asked about this, and one of the things he said, are we fighting against an American power structure? No. Are we fighting against the English power structure, a French power structure? No, we're fighting against an international, Western, global power structure. So what does this mean? Let's take, for instance, Africa. Africa is the richest continent in the world. There's no nation or continent richer than Africa. But if you look at Africa, it doesn't look very rich. Everything comes from Africa. All of these natural mineral resources, oil, gold, diamonds, all of these things. But the problem is that Africa is not owned by Africans. Africa is owned by Europe. You know, these countries here are owned by France. These countries here are owned by Germany. These countries here are owned by England. You know, different territory. Africa has been carved up, and it's owned by different countries of Europe. America, they took the bodies. They took the black bodies. Europe didn't want the black bodies. They just wanted the resources. So you look at how people live here in Canada. You look at how people live in America. You look at how people live in Europe. That's because Africa is being raised by them. This is why. I can say that there's countries in the east of Africa that have enough food alone to supply both the east and the west. But if they want to take it from the east to the west, they have to cross through the middle, and that middle territory might be owned by the French. So when they cross that border, it has to be taxed. And by the time they get it over, then there's nothing that's really left. You know, you look at a country like Haiti. Haiti was colonized by the French. You know, look at the condition that they're in today. So this is something that we need to keep in mind. I remember, when I was younger, I saw this movie called Original Gangsters. And in this movie, it stars an actor named Pam Grier, and also this famous football player. And it takes place in Gary, Indiana, which is close to the border of Canada. And in this movie, the gist of it is you have these local gangs in the community that are terrorizing the community, terrorizing each other. They have no respect for each other. They have no respect for the inhabitants of the community, the businesses of the community. They have no respect for human life. So then you have these old timers who back in the day belonged to certain groups and clubs, yet at least they stood for a certain set of laws and principles. So what they do, the old timers, they get together and they try to devise a plan on how they can take the community back from these young thugs who have everything misconstrued. So they plan, plot, and strategize, and then they implement it. And what it was a divide and conquer strategy. So they go to these gangs, and they throw all these little things in the mix, getting the gangs to fight each other, pitting one against the other. And the gangs begin to fight each other, not realizing all along that there are outside forces pulling the strings. So they continue to fight each other, and it goes on to the extent to where they no longer have the willpower or determination to keep on fighting, tying each other off. They don't have the resources to continue on. And when this happens, the OGs, the old timers, they come in and they easily wipe everybody else out. And this is something that's going on today, you know, where the real OGs, the real gangsters, the ones who many of us have adopted this culture from, are select businessmen, government officials, and politicians. And what they do is they pit us one against the other, you know, waiting for us to tire each other out so they can come in and wipe us out. You know, I remember I was in Syria and I taught English. And there were many other teachers there that taught English also. And they used to come from like England or America. And I tried to keep my distance from other Americans because generally I didn't really understand why they were there. They weren't there to study Islam. They weren't Muslim. I didn't understand what they did. But you know, I did meet people who I know for a fact, they study Middle Eastern studies. You know, they learn how to speak Arabic. And then they come to the Middle East, maybe a place like Afghanistan, and they grow a long beard and they fast during the month of Ramadan and they pretend to be Muslim. And then they'll go bomb a Shia mosque, and then they'll declare, we are Sunni. And then they'll go and bomb a Sunni mosque, and then they'll declare, we are Shia. And then next thing you know, you have Sunni and Shia that begin fighting each other, not realizing that there are outside forces pulling these strings. They're fighting each other, not realizing that it's to the benefit of those in power. It's divide and conquer. That's the way and the model of the enemy. Mainstream media. No, I want to touch on the mainstream media. I heard your brother, you know, talking earlier today. I'm very, very leery of the mainstream media, and I'll tell you why. You know, the mainstream media does not have the best interests of the people at heart. I remember I was in prison. I never had a problem with any other prisoners, but I had a lot of problems with correctional officers who harbored a deep hatred for me due to my family lineage. So I had altercation. I ended up in a box, 23 and a half hours locked down. And I remember when you reach a certain level, they give you a pair of headphones, and you can take these headphones and you can plug them in and you can listen to CNN. So it's very interesting. You know, prison type of place, you think that everybody there would be cold-hearted, cold-blooded, animal, gangster, thug, but this is the image that they would want to portray or want you to believe, Lee, but this just isn't the case. Some of the most intelligent brothers I ever met in my life have been in the belly of the beast behind that wall. I can understand why they're there, I can understand why the system doesn't want to let them go. But you know, we would get a half an hour of rec. So when it came time for a half an hour of rec, the back of our cage would open, you'd step out into the cage, and it would be hundreds of cages. You know, hundreds of people out here stepped out into these cages, and we couldn't really see each other, but we could talk to each other. So you might be talking to a brother for years, and you never even saw his face. But what was interesting is that, you know, brothers would have these debates, and they would debate so eloquently about politics, about religion, or about whatever. And, you know, a lot of the information people would get, it came from CNN. And it wasn't too long after 9/11 when I was there, and I would sit and I would listen. And what I noticed is that everybody would give a different opinion, a different spin, a different viewpoint on all the exact same information that they got from CNN. So it got me thinking, what about the people who control CNN? What about the people who control the information that you have access to? And this is very, very dangerous. One of the things that my grandfather said, that the media is a very dangerous thing, because through the media, they have the power to make the oppressor look like the victim, and the victim look like the oppressor. And, you know, all the people who own, same people that own all major media outlets are the same people who own Hollywood. It's the same people who own all major distribution labels for music. You know, the same people, music, movies, media, same people own all of this. If you research it and look towards the top, Zionists, you know, not to be confused with Jews, but Zionists. And through this power, they have the ability to manipulate the popular opinion of the masses on a large scale. To the cigarette that you smoke, the car that you drive, the clothes that you wear, your taste in men, your taste in women, all of these things are subtly manipulated, you know, through media, music, and movies. And this is very dangerous, and this is something that we must always keep in mind. Me growing up, I was born as a Sunni Muslim, but I was raised in the church. And I came through the process, I came to the path of Shia Islam through a process of research and investigation. When I say I was born in the church, I mean, when I say I was raised in the church, I mean, every weekend on Sundays, I would go with family friends to the church. You know, I would be locked in the church from Friday afternoon up until Sunday night. I was involved in many Bible studies and Bible competitions and so forth, and it really served as a source of strength. One day, One time I was in the Middle East, and there was this friend of mine who asked me to go to church with him. I was in Syria, an Islamic country, but it was an area that's all Christian. And so the person asked me to go to church with him, and I said, sure, no problem. So we went to the church, and we're in there, and they're praising the Lord, how they chose to do so, sing and dance and so forth. And I was off to the side by myself with some beads. This sister had approached me, and she said, do you mind if I ask you some questions? No, she said, aren't you a Muslim? And I said, yes. And she said, well, what are you doing here in the church? And I said, you know, I was invited with a friend. She said, well, do you mind if I ask you some questions? I said, sure, right ahead. She said, why is it that you see some of the Muslim women, they wear the hijab, but some of the Muslim women, they don't? And I said, well, do you do what you see people do, or do you do what has been revealed to you in your book from your Lord? And she said, okay, fair enough. She said, do you mind if I ask you some more? I said, go right ahead. I think she wanted to test me. So she asked me, why don't you guys eat pork? I asked her to bring me a Bible. So she brought me a Bible, and I went to Leviticus. And in Leviticus, there's a whole set of dietary laws. I showed it to her. I said, here, there's a whole set of dietary laws. One of the things we're not supposed to do is eat pork. Jews go by it. Muslims go by it. Why don't you go by it? She said, well, I'm Christian, and as a Christian, we don't go by the Old Testament, we go by the New Testament. I said, okay, cool. Well, being that you just previously asked me about the hijab, let's go to the New Testament, which you said you follow as a Christian, and 2 Corinthians. And in 2 Corinthians, it states that if the woman is to enter a church, or if she is to pray to her Lord, then she is to cover her hair. And if she doesn't cover her hair, then it's better that all of her hair be shorn, that she shave her hair off. I said, in Islam, we don't even say this. And she said, wow, you know, I've read the Bible front to back many times, and this is something that's never even stood out to me. I said, look around right here, right now, in this church, and how many women have their hair covered? None. So I asked her, I said, well, what about the mother of Jesus, peace be upon him? How does she dress? Didn't she have her hair covered? She said, yes, this is true. I said, well, what about the best of your women, the nuns? How do they dress? Don't they cover their hair? She said, yes, this is true. I said, well, did you know in the Quran, there's an entire chapter named after the mother of Jesus, Mary, peace be upon her. She said, no, I didn't know this. She said, in the Quran, do you know it mentions Jesus, peace be upon him, more than it does Muhammad, peace be upon him? She said, no, I didn't know this. And it mentions Moses more than the other prophet, I believe. Salawat. Allah, salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. One of the things that I told her, I said, well, if you had Jesus, Moses, Muhammad, Abraham, peace be upon them all, in the same room, at the same time, you think that they would be arguing and debating with each other? Of course not, because they were all on the same team. They all brought the same message, one God. They all praised that same God. So many times it's us, the people, who get this message confused. You know, a lot of people, they know about Malcolm X, but they don't know about El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz. You know, they know about Malcolm X, the fiery speaker from the Nation of Islam. Black man is a God, the white man is a devil, we need to separate. But a lot of people don't know about El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz when he came back from Mecca, you know. And this is something that we need to look into and study more. I'll readdress the issue real quick, but the brother just handled it so eloquently. So just to reiterate, you know, some of the things he said, maybe I'll make a point or two different. But it's the issue of the civil rights versus the human rights, you know. Many people, they ask me, what do you think about the movie about your grandfather? Do you believe that it's accurate? And what I'll say is that I believe the movie produced by Spike Lee is very accurate, just inadequate. And the reason why I say this is because in the movie, you see a little bit of his childhood, then you see him dropping out of school, he's ripping and running in the street, he gets locked up and goes to prison, he converts to the Nation of Islam, he comes home, he goes to Mecca and embraces Sunni Islam, comes back and he's assassinated, and then the movie's over. You would never know that he sat down with kings and princes and rulers from all over the world. You would never know he sat down with Fidel Castro of Cuba, or Prince Faisal of Saudi Arabia, who later became the king, or his relationship with Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana, or Patrice Lumumba. These things aren't in the movie or the book. You know, so this is something that's unfortunate and is very interesting. But you know, throughout my grandfather's travels to these different countries, one of the things that he realized is that many people here in the United States, they're fighting a civil rights issue. And as a civil rights issue, that means it's fought within the court. And that means that it also remains domestic. No outside country can get involved, and the United Nations cannot take any action because it's civil. And as a civil rights issue, you know, they would fight it in the court, and they would go as high as they could go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court knocking back down to the state. They would say, this is outside of our jurisdiction. They would give it back to the state. But the state, they were the ones perpetuating the injustice, perpetuating the crime, like the state police, who were sicking dogs on women and children and spraying them with high power hoses. So it was the game. Civil rights issue, it wasn't going to go anywhere. So what my grandfather realized is that we need to stop isolating this issue to just our own people here in America, but we need to link our struggle, the struggle of the so-called African-American, to the struggle of the South African with apartheid, to the struggle of our brothers and sisters in the Middle East, with our struggle to those being oppressed in Latin America, and so forth. So we stopped isolating it and calling it a civil rights issue, and he called it a human rights issue, and he linked the struggle. And then he was prepared to take the United States up on charges before the United Nations. And this is when I guess he became a real threat. He said that we gotta get him out of here. Many people, they meet me, they ask me, well, what do you do? What is your platform on? And I remember when I first came home from prison and I wanted to give back, and I was giving all, I wanted to speak to the youth, I wanted to basically do what I'm doing right now, and I was giving all the reasons why I couldn't do what I'm doing right now, why I couldn't speak to the youth. Told me, well, you just came home from a maximum security prison, or you don't have a college degree, and just all the reasons why I couldn't do what I'm doing right now. And many of us go through the same thing. I hear many people, they come home from prison and they say, man, I can't get a job. You know, it's hard for an ex-fella to get a job, or I'm not allowed to vote, or I'm not allowed to travel. When I came home, these were things that I believed. I didn't know I could travel, and I just tried it, and it worked out, and I was able to travel all over the world. People say they can't get jobs. I remember, you know, a few times, a few brothers I know did ex-cons, and they would go, and they would fill out the application, and then the boss would say, all right, we'll be giving you a call. They would wait for the call, they would never get the call. Then they would say, okay, well, I didn't get the job, it must be true. No, you can't listen to what others dictate to you, you gotta take the initiative. So like one of the things I would do is, let's say I'm trying to get this certain type of job. I would fill out 10 applications and I would hand them in. But before I hand them in, I wouldn't just wait for you to call me, I would get their number. And then I would make a list and I would have 10 jobs, 10 numbers, and every day I would go down the list and check them off one by one. Hey, this is Malcolm Shabazz. I'm calling to check up on the status of my application. You know, every damn day, 10, check, check, check. So out of these 10, somebody's gonna get tired of me calling. Or they're gonna say, man, this guy's really serious about getting his job, or let's just get him in here and see what he has to say. But you have to take that initiative. You know, you can't wait for others, you can't let others dictate to you what you can and can't do. You know, I'm traveling all around America, you know, you see different mentalities and so forth. New York, where I live, very interesting place. I mean, I've been places all over America. I might not have a dime in my pocket, and alhamdulillah, there are different forces that they might not even like each other, but people will put the differences to the side and come together to get something accomplished. And I get to New York, and I just got off a flight, and I'm making some phone calls. People I know 10 years, hey, I just touched down at the airport, I need a ride. Well, that's gonna cost you $70. $70? I know you 10 years. Brother, this is a recession. One of the things I really stress is the importance of education and unity. When I say education, you know, my grandfather stated that education is our passport to the future, for tomorrow only belongs to those who plan to prepare for it today. Huey P. Newton, who started Black Panther Party, stated that no movement is successful without the support of the people. And my thing is that in order to have the support of the people, sometimes we need to be educated and made aware of our cause, because oftentimes we don't even know, or we're not even aware of our own condition. By show of hands, how many of you are familiar with Harriet Tubman? Harriet Tubman. She was the leader of the Underground Railroad to free slaves. And she used to try to, when she freed them, they would run away, and she would actually bring them north towards Canada, where they would have more freedom. One of the things that Harriet Tubman said is that she could have freed a lot more slaves if only they had realized that they were slaves. So this means that during a time of physical slavery, chains, shackles, whips, we had brothers and sisters that couldn't be convinced to flee from the plantation due to their thorough indoctrination, and bondage was all that they knew. And this is something that extends all the way up until today, where you have brothers and sisters walking around here thinking that they're free, they're actually slaves. You know, think about a stray dog that you see out on the street. You try to approach it, it's gonna snap at you, or it's gonna try to flee. Yet, if you're able to subdue that dog, you put a leash around its neck, you tie it up to a tree, and every time it gets hungry, you begin to feed it. And you keep feeding it. Then the dog will become dependent upon you. And then there'll come a time when you take the chain off of the dog, and it will no longer try to snap at you, and it will no longer try to flee. It will stick right by your side. And this is something that many of us suffer from today. I'm going to share this one other analogy. It's a true story. I have a friend. I was in Miami. I had a friend. He had this pet parrot. And you know, the parrot is said to have the mind of a 3-year-old. And it could talk. He taught it how to say all these words. It says Alhamdulillah. It says Allahu Akbar. It says Subhanallah. And it actually says Assalamu Alaikum, parrot. And it's very colorful. It's a beautiful bird. And he used to take a potato chip bag. You know, and he used to ruffle it. And when he would ruffle the potato chip bag, the bird would spread its wings out, and it would start to do this little dance. So it was really interesting. And then it had this beak, and the beak was very sharp. And one day I was sitting there, and I commented on the beak of this bird. And when I started to comment on the beak, I said, yeah, the bird's beak is very sharp. All of a sudden, the bird started to scratch his beak on the cage, like vigorously. And I said, why, what's going on here? And my friend said, you know, he can kind of understand when you're talking about his beak, and that's why he's doing that. Wow. This bird is very intelligent. But if he takes this bird out of the cage and he walks outside with it and he lets it go, it's going to fly away and come right back. Because that bondage is all that it knows. You know, so today we might not have a physical slavery, but there is mental chains that exist within many of us. Many of us are under the illusion that we've made much progress since the times of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Megan Evers, Sasha Shakur, and so forth. Many people think we've made much progress, but in all reality, we've taken a giant leap backwards in terms of the consciousness of the people. You know, in America, when we came through the civil rights period, the civil rights era, this black power movement, you had people like James Brown making songs, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. You know, people coming into their own, people rocking the Afro, people throwing black power fists, people protesting the Vietnam War. And if you fast forward to today, what has happened? You know, you got brothers out there killing each other. You have people that sell crack to your mother or your pregnant sister. And the majority of what you do contribute toward the deterioration of the community. So what happened? For a 10-year period, there were a lot of assassinations that took place from Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Sasha Shakur, Exile, Kennedy. They even assassinated their own president. It wasn't the different groups of people that were responsible for these assassinations. It was the same people. You know, they said you strike the head and the body will crumble. So education and unity. So I'll talk about unity real quick, being that our time is running out. I go a lot of different places and I speak to a lot of different people from different areas and backgrounds and walks of life. And, you know, it's difficult, especially when you're dealing with politics and religion, two of the most controversial topics. When you're dealing with politics and religion, a lot of different people, different areas and backgrounds, it opens up room for much debate. So it's unfortunate that today many of us, we can't work together because of our differences. I'm Shia, I'm Sunni, I'm W.D. Muhammad, I'm Nation Islam, I'm Christian, I'm Puerto Rican, I'm Dominican, I'm Lebanese, I'm Jordanian. We have all these things that keep us divided and keep us from working together. But what's important is that we don't always have to wear the same t-shirt. You know, you don't have to wear my t-shirt, and I'm not trying to wear your t-shirt. You know, I might not want to wear your t-shirt, but what's important is that we can meet up on common points of interest. So if we know we all agree on issues of police brutality, then let's meet up on around this issue of police brutality. If we know that we all agree on the fact that we need to show support for Haiti, then let's all get together and work around this issue of supporting Haiti. Let's not be focused on our differences. Let's be more focused so on what we have in common. I remember I was in prison, and I'll leave off with this. And when I went to prison, the workforce was 100% white. The majority of the prisoners were black and Hispanic, 70% black and Hispanic. And when I got in there, they would tell you, you know, you guys can kill each other all you want, just don't touch one of us and we'll be all right. So when we used to go to the yard, there would be a metal detector. When we used to go to the mess hall, there would be a metal detector. Now, one day that I was there, did we ever go to the metal detector? They would make us go around. So despite the fact of knowing what the reality of the situation was, brothers would still be out there trying to kill each other. So this is something that we need to keep on. Thank you. I'm Billy Dallas.
talk. So today we have heard five distinguished talks. One of them was very inspirational, one of them energizing, one of them emotional, one of them religious, and one of them shared life experiences. And me and my sister Elaf just found ourselves between the audience and the speaker. So we would like, on behalf of both of you, the organizers and the audience, to thank the speakers for all the inspirational, exceptional talks. Special thanks to Mr. Steve for his very inspirational and spiritual talk that took us in a journey deep within our hearts to search for truth and for love. We also thank Mr. Arundel for his talk, very, very energizing talk that taught us to be responsible, to search for the true information, for the true news, and then to act upon it daily, weekly, monthly, upon each one's ability. We also would like to thank Madame Flora for her emotional talk that connected us with our brothers in humanity in Kenya and connected us to all the needy and the oppressed women over there. We'd like also to thank Sheikh Ahmed Hani for this religious talk that showed us the liberating role of religion and how it asks and commands people and teach them to be active and to seek human justice. And last but not least, our thanks to Brother Malcolm Shabazz for his sharing with us his life experiences, his reflections, and teaching us from his perspective how to identify the real enemy, the contemporary gangsters who are pulling the strings from behind and making us see the oppressor as the oppressed. Thank you very much for each one of you. The last thing before you leave is the draw on the door prizes. So I would like to call Hilal and Sister Fatima.